pleasure to see and work with Greg. Members of the court, I sat down a couple weeks ago to try and do an outline for my presentation, and then I read your synopsis and realized I could not do a better job. So whoever wrote the synopsis for the court, this is a terrific outline.
Well, it's Tom Sheehan, who is our PR person, but he's not a lawyer, so I'll have to tell him he did a pretty good job.
It's really quite helpful because
he gets it from the staff. Pardon? He gets it from the staff commissioners, who are lawyers.
Well, it really is quite helpful because it really does provide a wonderful synopsis of Mr. Herman's and my brief, Mr. Herman's brief on behalf of OLR and my brief on behalf of Mr. Turan. And when I saw that I had 25 minutes to fill, I'm not going to try and fill all 25 of those minutes because there really is not a great deal of legal precedent in this case to address, but rather it's addressing what is appropriate in terms of resolving this case. As a bit of background that's not part of our briefs, not part of the facts, but I'll hope you'll allow this for a few moments, Mr. Turan is one of the most active practitioners in southeastern Wisconsin in terms of his responsibilities in criminal defense. He has 82 open cases right now in state court, and he really, literally, and I experience this too because I'm also a criminal defense practitioner, but we literally run from court to court, putting out fires, meeting with people late at night, being at the jail until 9, 10 o'clock at night. And we, you know, and I know this about Mr. Turan. I know that he tries to do the absolute best job that he can for everyone. And it would be not inappropriate, I think, to note that Mr. Turan is one of the few African-American practitioners who is in the position that he's in. And he does provide a great deal of service, often on a pro bono basis, to many people. And I know that about him, and I've told him not to do that because it causes him a lot of extra added grief. In this instance, Mr. Turan represented a man by the name of Bruce Segura, and he started out representing him in a battery case in the Circuit Court of Milwaukee. He earned a fee on that and took in a fee from Mr. Segura's mother, who's the OLR plaintiff, or complainant, rather, to OLR. Mr. Turan took in a fee of $1,000, and that fee then also included a second case that Mr. Segura picked up for intimidation of a witness. So at that juncture in time, Mr. Turan did not, under the Supreme Court rules, need to present a written fee agreement because if it's less than $1,000 or if it's $1,000 or less, there need not be a written fee agreement. And so part of what I discussed with Mr. Herman when I was trying to persuade him not to go forward with this matter was that I regarded that as a discrete agreement dealing with one issue, and then Mr. Segura picked up another issue, and that was his revocation based upon he was on extended supervision at the time. He picks up a revocation case, and he was represented initially by a public defender. He did not prevail in that revocation hearing. And then Mr. Segura's mother retained, or attempted to retain, I should say, Mr. Turan to do the second case, and that was for a writ of certiorari to the circuit court on to address the administrative action.
I have a question, counsel,
yes,
regarding
Justice
the second case,
yes,
and the issue of restitution.
Yes.
With regard to the second case, this is what I understand the facts to be. And if they are this way, I don't understand why restitution is not involved. I understand the facts to be that on this second case, and of course there's discussion regarding restitution on the first case, on the second case that a retainer of $1,000 was required or requested to file a writ of cert, that the complainant came up with only $500, paid only $500, and therefore no writ of cert was filed. So it would seem to me that restitution should be paid for the $500 that was given to file a writ when none was filed. Can you respond to that inquiry?
I can, Your Honor. Unfortunately, and as I tried to start talking about background, when a lawyer like us is running around, you often run into situations where you don't have your fee agreement with you at the time that you meet with somebody. You might hand them a receipt. And to directly answer to your question, what occurred was Mr. Turan should have had a written agreement at that point in time, and I think that would have been the better practice, and he agrees with that. That the better practice at that point in time would have been to say, Ms. Segura, here's a written fee agreement. I will commence the certiorari petition at the time that you've paid me it was actually for $1,500 was the amount that I understood it to be, but he was going to file the petition upon the receipt of $1,500. I'll get to that.
When you say better practice, doesn't the law require it if it's $1,500?
Yeah, absolutely. But sometimes what occurs is you start collecting money, and then at the time that you reach that precipice of $1,000, that's the point in time that you sit down and actually, you might give a receipt ahead of time, and then at the point in time when you actually receive the full amount, then that's the point in time that you would file or prepare a written fee agreement. And I agree with you, and as does Mr. Turan. Now, what Mr. Turan interrupted me to say is that he actually has a printed form of a fee contract. He recalls having presented that to her, but he did not maintain a copy of it for himself.
But I think Justice Bradley's question was more to restitution, which
yes.
I'm interested in. Why doesn't he owe her $500?
Here's what the direct answer to both of your questions is this. Mr. Turan recalls having given her $500 back at the time that he turned over the file. But again, there's no receipt that he has a copy of to show that. And so the answer is, in the absence of any sort of receipt, we'd agree that he does owe her the $500 and it will be paid.
So I understand that the stipulation was for restitution in the amount of $500, but I understood that was with regard to the first case.
That's a misunderstanding then.
Okay,
Your Honor.
I'm
misunderstanding. And it may have been a misunderstanding of the author the agreement. The agreement was that it was applied on the second case. It's very clear that Mr. Turan earned a fee on the first portion of that. I don't think there's any dispute on that. In any regard, we do agree with that, and what I initially started saying when I was trying to convince Mr. Herman to proceed otherwise was that these are two discrete acts, and perhaps until the threshold is required of having the fee contract of $1,000, that we should view these as separate events. But in this instance, OLR chose to lump together two acts that were taken on the part of the Segura family. The reason I'd say that these are two discrete acts is if this were, if we were in a civil situation and I was retained to write a contract one day for a client, and then a couple days later the same client came to me and said, I need you to perform another act, file a small claims case for me. In that case, we'd have two separate discrete acts, and I don't think that they would be lumped together under a singular event where it would exceed the $1,000 requirement for a written fee agreement. However, the better practice here and why we're in this position is, had that been part of a written agreement, we wouldn't be discussing what I'm talking about at all. So we are conceding, and we've stipulated, that we have no ability to show that this money was repaid. Mr. Turan believes he did pay it, but he's willing to concede that he does owe the restitution. The question really becomes, what is the appropriate discipline for this? And
so you're not really fighting the charges.
Judge, we're here because we entered a stipulation and we're not fighting the charges.
So the question then becomes the appropriate sanction.
That is correct.
In light of the disciplinary record.
That is correct, Your
client,
Honor.
Client, right? I understand it, the referee recommended 1 year. Your client thinks the appropriate discipline would be a public reprimand, and that the OLR thinks your client should be suspended for less than 6 months so that he could get back in without petitioning or without making the appropriate proof, but that the OLR doesn't say what the suspension should be other than it's...
Well, I think you're going to hear from Mr. Herman.
Okay, I will wait.
Judge, and I don't mean to interrupt, or Justice Abramson, I don't mean to interrupt, and I'm not arguing.
You're absolutely right. The OLR is represented here and can see if my understanding is correct.
Well, I had actually suggested that perhaps Mr. Herman and I should be doing a joint presentation because there are so many facts that we agree on so much, including the fact that the year suspension is kind of out of the pale.
If there had been no disciplinary history, what do you think the appropriate discipline would be here?
Given what I know of what, if there had been no disciplinary history, it could have been resolved either with a diversion agreement, which is a practice of OLR, or perhaps at greatest a private reprimand.
Okay.
And that's based upon, I've represented other lawyers and written responses for lawyers and know what the results are. So it's based upon my knowledge.
Yeah. So obviously there is disciplinary history, and I'm sure you're aware that we favor the progressive discipline approach, right?
It's what I argued for in my brief, Your Honor.
Okay. So how do we apply that to a let's call it a minor issue like this? Right? So I understand that there's has been a 6 month suspension before. Do you say we progress from the 6 months to something else, or do we look at were there prior incidents that are similar to this one, and then progress from there?
I think it's the latter rather than the former. And the reason for that is because if you look at the history, and I say this because I'm well aware of the history, in 1989, Mr. Turan had a drug problem. He was a member of the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office at the time, and he did have a drug problem. He overcame the drug problem and was reinstated by the bar. The other matters, the 1991 matter, I believe, was a private reprimand, and I think the 2012 matter was a public reprimand. And I think that you have to look at what the appropriate sanction is for this type of conduct. You know, Mr. Turan is not a thief. And Mr. Turan is a person who I think has earned the opportunity to have something short of going beyond that 28-year-old or 29-year-old sanction that he suffered.
Counsel, I would like to back up a little bit. And first of all, Mr. Turan, congratulations on overcoming that grave difficulty of addiction. I'd like to go back a little bit. To the best of my knowledge, I'm the only member of this bench to have presided for a week at the Milwaukee County Courthouse when I first started. A week.
Okay, Judge, we have...
What?
Justice Bradley.
You're being challenged by a colleague on a statement.
Oh, I was in.
I was, yeah.
My knowledge, he said.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't at children's court, to be fair. I was at misdemeanor court. Judge Charles Kahn and I switched places for a week early on in my tenure when I was a circuit court judge in Burnett County. And so does the record shows, this is a question, that your client for all this time has been focusing his practice in Milwaukee County representing criminal defendants?
The answer to that question is yes, primarily. I mean, Mr. Turan also goes to other counties in southeastern Wisconsin. He'll be in Waukesha, he'll be in Racine, he'll be in Kenosha, he'll be in Washington County, he'll be in Sheboygan, sometimes in Manitowoc. I mean, you practice in southeast Wisconsin,
sure,
get around.
Well, and that might be a part and parcel of maybe some of his clients get around, too. And so...
Point well taken.
Okay. So I am... I have a particular insight into the, shall we say, press of business in Milwaukee County. And so I hear what you're saying.
Thank you.
In terms of that. And I just wanted to clarify that the record does bear out that that is where he's been spending his career. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
It is. And it's a very, very difficult community of clients.
One thing that struck me is when I was in Burnett County, if I wanted, for whatever reason, the lawyers told me they had reached a plea agreement, and we could get somebody, for instance, we could get their case resolved, and they were being held in the jail. The jail was one floor above the courtroom, and so all I had to do were my wonderful judicial assistant for 6 years, Mary Heinrichs, just called upstairs and said, can we see so-and-so, and 10 minutes later they'd be down. Well, I learned quickly that there was a 24-hour policy at that time to get a prisoner over, and it was quite cumbersome. And I remember being chastised by an administrator a couple of times for going a few minutes over the noon hour. And I remember it was the one and only time I had conducted two jury trials in one day. So I just say that for what it's worth to reflect back in this venue the particular challenges of Milwaukee County, because I think it is particularly salient in this particular case.
Well, thank you, Justice. I appreciate your comments.
Counsel, for the purposes of analyzing the progressive discipline aspect of this, which of the prior disciplinary actions should we look at as a base?
Well, Your Honor, I would say look at the um, several, I mean, look at the ones from 1991, 2012, and 2007. And I think that that is the route that you should start with. I'm asking the court to just really disregard something that was the result of illness. And I regard addiction as an illness.
Yeah, let's say we do, because this is just not of the same nature, right?
Correct.
So so help me with this. Can you, of the prior incidents, were they all of the same nature as this?
No.
Okay. Which, if any of them, were similar in nature to this?
None.
Okay. All right. So, how do we apply, I'm just struggling with this, how do we apply the progressive discipline aspect of this? Do we, what do we attach that to and why?
Well, I think that what we have to look at is look at similar cases. And one of the reasons I didn't file a reply brief is because I found the same cases that Mr. Herman did, and it was like, why tell the court this again? But I really think that it's an issue of, I really regard Mr. Turan's failing here as a lack of documentation. And for a lack of documentation, I think that, I would think that a public reprimand is sufficient. That's what I argue for. I can certainly understand, based upon Mr. Herman's view, a 60-day suspension or less, but I just, the year is just over the top as far as I'm concerned, and I hope that you see it the same way. And I don't mean to be disparaging, but if you read what was the absence of analysis in the recommendation, I just didn't understand the jump in logic. But, Justice, I would ask you to hold Mr. Turan accountable for his conduct, but I don't think that his conduct necessitates being removed from the practice. I think that he has learned a valuable and invaluable lesson from this, and I think other practitioners will learn from this as well. Just reading the blurb that you get in Wisconsin Lawyer, and you get that pitted out feeling in your stomach thinking, did I do this too? So
let's just... as a final matter, I look back at, and let's set aside the 6-month suspension, and I see one private reprimand, two public reprimands. And if we apply the progressive nature discipline to that, what's the proper quantum of that progression here?
Well, you know, that is the question that I think that I'm struggling with, and I think Mr. Herman struggled with as well. I think that because it's different than the other matters, that perhaps it's a starting point of, you know, when you're dealing with other people's money and dealing with contractual issues, here's how you've got to be better. And it's something that we can all learn from if it were a public reprimand. And if, when you're dealing with other people's money, you certainly want to have as good a record system as you can. And so my opinion is that if you learn from something little, you won't go on to something big. And so this is a situation where I'm hoping that the court will also see it as something that if somebody dipped into the trust account, if somebody failed to provide services, any services for money that they took, then in that instance, I would think that the progression should move from there, because this is really different in so many respects from the other matters.
Okay, thank you.
Is the only complaint of the complainant who filed a request for a disciplinary action that there wasn't a repayment of the restitution? Wasn't it also that no services were provided that were promised and paid for?
they weren't paid for, but it's in, I guess that's what she was, I mean, that, it was difficult to discern from the testimony, because I sat through her testimony exactly what she was asking for, but I think it was the money.
Okay, all right. And is $500 the limit to the money she wants back?
Well, she had made a claim for more, but no one could figure out what it should have been or
okay.
what it could be.
All right, thank you. Well, maybe opposing counsel will help us with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, members of the court.
Chief Justice, members of the court, good morning, Mr. Chernin. My name is Greg Herman. I'm the retained counsel by OLR in this matter. As Mr. Chernin mentioned, there was a stipulation of facts in which Mr. Turan not only admitted that all of the facts in the complaint, which was filed on behalf of OLR, could be utilized by the referee in this court in making determinations of misconduct, but also that he was pleading no contest to three counts of ethical violations. The stipulation and Mr. Turan's admission to that the court could utilize those facts and that he was pleading no contest was not the result of any plea negotiations. This is not a case where we offered, we'll recommend such and such if you plead or something else if you don't. We told Mr. Turan that OLR does not engage in plea negotiations, that we believe that based upon several factors that I'll mention in a moment, that the appropriate discipline in this case would be a suspension of 60 days and restitution in the amount of $500.
I thought you advanced an argument for suspension of less than 6 months.
No, and in our brief, if you'll notice, Your Honor, it states in the conclusion part that our recommendation at the time of trial.
At the time of trial was, so you asked for 60 days.
Yeah, if I can, from our brief, Your Honor, it states OLR submits that given Turan's prior record, a period of suspension is necessary. OLR's position remains that a 60-day suspension can be considered as consistent with prior disciplinary cases.
Okay,
so what we meant by that is that our recommendation at trial to the referee was that we felt a 60-day suspension was appropriate, and we don't penalize respondents for either contesting the case. It would have been the same recommendation if we had gone to trial on all the counts, and we don't increase the recommendation because Mr. Turan chose to appeal the referee's order. The recommendation of OLR was based upon what we felt to be the factors. I'll talk about what I feel to be the two most important ones in a moment. And we felt at the time of issuing the complaint that 60 days was appropriate. Obviously, if facts arise during trial that indicates the conduct was either more or less egregious than we had thought it was, we could change that. That's not the case here.
What conduct do you believe that he's admitted supports a 60-day suspension?
The three counts that he is admitted to violating, the first is the failure to produce a written fee agreement, and I disagree with one thing that Mr. Chernin said. Mr. Chernin said that the rule is that you have to have a written fee agreement if the fees exceed $1,000. It's not exactly what the rule says. What the rule says is you have to have a written fee agreement if it is reasonably contemplated that the fees will exceed $1,000.
Okay, so I think he agrees now, though, that he should have had one.
Yes.
So what's the other? I want to get the conduct. What are
the second? The second one was failing to refund the $500 because.
So that's the $500 restitution.
Yes, and then the third count was for not maintaining the funds in trust, because unless you have an agreement, unless your fee agreement provides that you're going to treat fees as an advance payment, you need to put in writing to clients several factors that this court has made part of the rule, that if you're not keeping it in trust, the client must be informed in writing that the money is refundable, the basis for the fees, and a binding fee arbitration.
What was the amount of money that he got that he didn't put in trust?
He didn't put any of it in trust, Your Honor.
Well, what is the amount of money you're complaining about that he should have put in trust?
We should have put all of it in trust.
What is the dollar amount?
$2,500.
How much?
$2,500
okay.
was the total.
Thank you.
And it all should have been in trust because you could do one of two things as a lawyer. You either put it in trust and then bill against it, or treat it as an advance fee, but then you need a supplemental written agreement with your client on the basis. And Mr. Turan didn't do either of those things. He didn't keep in trust, and he didn't have the supplemental agreement. So that's, I believe that was actually count two of the complaint. The reason there may be some confusion in terms of the restitution is Ms. Segura felt that the restitution should have been more than $500. So we had a very brief hearing in front of the referee to give her a right to testify to state her reason why. Ms. Segura hired Mr. Turan on behalf of her son, and she felt that he didn't do adequate and professional and the work that he was hired to do. OLR's feeling is there's a difference.
First of all, thank you for your work as an investigator and attorney for OLR. I've recently had opportunity, as you know.
I was online, yes, Your Honor.
To do some work with the retained counsel, and I've gotten a particular insight, especially when it comes to the remuneration that they receive.
Or lack thereof.
Well, and I that's why I say your service, and so thank you.
Thank you. It's a form of pro bono work, and it's a pleasure to do it. And thank you for appearing, speaking to us that day, Your Honor.
It was a pleasure. Tell me, what does the record tell us what the outcome for the client was?
No, it doesn't. And Ms. Segura's feeling is it wasn't adequate.
Well, but the record shows that she was upset because, you know, she's paying the money, but because of the ethical rules prohibiting Mr. Turan from giving out information, that she felt that she wasn't being adequately informed as to what was going on. Did you get the impression that that had something to do with it, that she was upset with the attorney because he was properly maintaining the confidences of his client?
It could be, Your Honor. And OLR did not feel, and I wasn't part of the investigative process. I get involved after the administrative board decides to issue charges. But apparently they did not decide that his conduct in representing Mr. Segura rose to the level of a lack of diligence of a 1.3 violation. So that was not issued. What was issued as far as the $500 is because he did no work whatsoever in terms of earning that. So there's a difference between taking a fee and the client being not satisfied with the work, not satisfied with the result, and taking a fee and doing no work whatsoever.
And that was on the writ of certiorari.
And that was the writ of certiorari. Mr. Turan admits that he didn't perform any services because he never got the rest of the payment.
Okay.
And therefore he did nothing, but he also didn't refund the $500.
Got it.
So OLR's position was that we're not asking for restitution for payment based upon the fact that she was dissatisfied with his services. There's another avenue if she wishes to pursue that legally for being dissatisfied with the attorney's services, but this is the appropriate avenue when you take a fee and do no work whatsoever.
Tell me that I'm again incorrect. That is, I thought the facts were that she was claiming that she paid more on the first matter, the first case, than was recognized by OLR or Attorney Turan.
Well, I can't tell you with OLR. She clearly felt she paid more than the results she got from the services.
Okay. But I thought there was a
And she would have liked restitution.
She paid supplementally, she said.
Yeah, and please understand that, you know, we talk about the defendants in Milwaukee. Ms. Segura is a very, very nice lady who's trying to get help for her son. To her, $2,500 would be like $250,000 to us. I mean, that's just a huge amount of money to her. So coming up with that, which required a great deal of effort and work and all this, and not getting the results you wanted, was something that bothered her very, very deeply.
This is what I'm referring to. The complaint with regard to this, I think, indicates that $1,500 was paid by her.
Yes.
And she, at the hearing, said, no, that's not right. I paid a total of $2,500.
There were different payments made at different times. And part of the reason why OLR alleged, and Mr. Tran admitted there should have been a written plea agreement, is what he did is he took $1,000 up front, and I believe it was $800, and then another $700, and it came piecemeal. And she was a little confused in terms of exactly when she made the payments and how much.
Fair enough. This case seems to be arguing on whether there should be a reprimand or a what would be referred to as a minimal suspension under our precedent. Give me your best argument why you need a suspension.
There, among the factors, and OLR takes this very, very seriously, and there's a great deal of time and work and thought that goes into making the recommendation. Among the factors, there are two primary ones in this case. The first is the one that Justice Kelly mentioned earlier, which is the concept of progressive discipline. While sometimes that's been honored more in theory than in practice in this court, it's really a simple idea that if somebody commits a violation, no more than a child taking a cookie from the cookie jar, and the first time they get a warning, second time maybe there should be a timeout, and the third time maybe a little longer timeout. And we have 22,000 lawyers in the state, of which 0.02% every year are a subject of discipline. It's extremely rare. We have an extremely fine bar in the state, and it's very rare. So when a lawyer has been disciplined four prior times, that's a lot. And to say that, okay, well, it's four prior disciplinary proceedings, but the facts are a little different than this one, so it's another slap on the hand, OLR believe violates the principle of progressive discipline. The second reason is the concept, and again, it's a simple one, that to the extent humanly possible, like conduct should be treated in a like manner in like cases. That becomes extremely difficult for you because trying to analyze one case against another and finding anything that matches, just in the practice of law alone when we do cases and hear cases argued before you, is impossible. But in discipline cases, they're all different because you have different types of conduct, different types of violations, and different types of records. In my brief to you...
Counsel, perhaps you could help me out with just a little bit. I'm looking for... The way I'm looking at it is I want to find a baseline that we can then apply our progressive discipline to get to the right result. So perhaps we can look at it this way. If there had been no prior disciplinary history at all, what would have been the proper discipline for this event?
No more than a public reprimand. Possibly, if Mr. Tran had practiced 30-some years and had no prior history at all, not that any, I don't want to be you to read into this, that any violation of the ethics is a minor matter. I think any violation of ethical rules is an important matter. But in the context of all of the violations that OLR sees, this would have warranted no more than a public and perhaps a private reprimand.
Okay.
So the primary reason for that this case matches the other cases, I think I cited four other cases in my brief where there were violations of a similar nature in which the attorney had a prior disciplinary history in which this court found the suspension was appropriate. And then we walk this tightrope, okay, we're past that point where a suspension would be appropriate because this is his fifth violation. And it's not the fifth complaint. It's not the fifth grievance. It's not the fifth time prosecuted. It's the fifth time he's been found to have violated. He's been convicted of violating ethical rules. We're at the point of, okay, this has to be something more severe than just the public reprimand. Then the question comes, do we go up to 6 months or beyond it? Because 6 months is really the huge gap where you have to petition for reinstatement and essentially extends the time for perhaps another 6 months, even a year. The feeling of OLR was that looking at the precedent that's cited in our brief, that in other cases, even with this disciplinary history, the discipline has been less than 6 months. So there gets to be somewhat of an arbitrary number if you ask between 30 days, 60 days, or 90 days that there's no science to.
Right.
And
so,
it's more a matter of judgment.
Yeah. So your recommendation is 60 days. And so this, would it be correct to say the analysis would be that given the number of prior disciplines, that the progression from something between a private and a public reprimand, that the quantum of the progression requires 60 days because of the number of prior disciplines?
Yes.
Okay.
And that also would be consistent then with prior cases, what this court has done with attorneys who have committed violations which other than their prior record would have been a public reprimand, and in those cases the court has imposed a relatively short suspension. So we feel that this is consistent with other cases before the court, and you know, OLR may feel in an individual case that the conduct is more or less severe, but it's OLR's goal to try to make our recommendations consistent with recommendations in similar cases to the extent we can analogize. I'm not sure that's a word, but I think you'll understand it, one case to another.
Okay. Thank you.
So the recommendation then, Your Honor, is that OLR is recommending that, first of all, do you accept the stipulation that it's not binding on this court? Court is free to reject the stipulation. We hope you will accept the stipulation that Mr. Turan has violated three ethical rules, that a period of suspension of 60 days would be appropriate, that he pay restitution of $500 to Ms. Segura, and that he pay the cost of these proceedings. Absent any other questions, thank you very much for your time and attention.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I think I overstayed my welcome on my last go around at the light.
Counsel, Mr. Herman indicates that if there had been no prior disciplinary history, the proper resolution would have been something between a private and a public reprimand. Do you agree with that, and if not, why?
Well, if there had been no prior discipline, there is a third alternative, and it's the one that I mentioned in my first go-round, and that's that OLR does offer diversion programs where somebody needs to have some learning curve on something. Then they do offer diversion programs as well. So I hope that answers your question.
Counsel, I would disagree with what you said about you overstaying your welcome. I think you've been providing very helpful information. And I want to ask something to that end. You had made a reference towards the conclusion of your first portion of the argument. You said something, and I didn't quite hear it clearly, and I should have asked you at the time. You said something about 60 days, about a 60-day suspension, and I think you must have known, well, you obviously knew. Is that something, knowing that it's not binding and knowing that in an ideal world you would say it should not be any suspension at all, if the court were to look at a suspension, would your client say that 60 days is just beyond the pale? Is that about?
Well, to be quite candid, I mean, I'm going to be totally candid.
You've been so, everyone has been so far, and that's the only reason I feel comfortable asking.
Well, and the truth of the matter is, it's what Mr. Herman actually said about this isn't really, there is no science to this. This is totally an art. And in terms of what I've seen from other cases, and that's what I would refer back to, and that's why when I said Mr. Herman and I found the same cases, we did. I had a couple others, but they really didn't add much to the discussion. But somewhere, if it's going to be a suspension, it doesn't necessarily have to go to 60. It could be 30. But, you know, is that within the realm of something reasonable? It's far more reasonable than the alternatives that were presented by the referee. And I think that it's within the realm of
fair enough.
Fairness.
Fair enough. Thank you.
But again, I understood you.
Court doesn't usually suspend for 30 days. We have under special circumstances, but there's also something in the rules that indicate that the minimum suspension is 60 days.
Well, Your Honor, I know and I've seen that, and I was looking for a 30-day case, and that's why I didn't offer one in a reply brief.
Well, I think it was Humphreys and another Madison attorney, and I think that was the 30 days. There may be others, and I may be wrong at what I'm citing you to.
No.
It has been done.
Actually, Your Honor, you're not, you were not incorrect. I did see the same things that you discussed, that you were just saying. So, thank you. Oh, the one thing I do just want to add is there's two things that I hear out of what occurred, and that is, if Ms. Segura thought that Mr. Turan was doing such a horrible job for her son in the first case, why did she want him for the revocation hearing? And second of all, in terms of when you look at the small number of disciplines that occur, the largest number of disciplinary complaints and also those who are disciplined the most happen to be in the areas of law that Mr. Herman and I practice, which is family law and criminal defense. And when you look at the volume of cases that Mr. Trans had, I understand their disciplinary actions, but I think that given two factors there, the volume and the client base of people who feel helpless and have somebody to complain to, comes into play.
He's a sole practitioner?
He is a sole practitioner.
And what is his office staff?
You are looking primarily at
so it. So he doesn't have an assistant that files things for him and prepares things for him?
No.
Thank you.
Although his former wife does help him from time to time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for an interesting argument. It's always unsettling to lawyers when they are brought here, and somewhat unsettling to the court as well. So we take care with these cases and appreciate your good briefs and your good arguments. We are adjourned, and the court will meet in closed conference at 1:30.